Well, a couple of days ago, we had set out to try to say something about the two truths as they are expressed in the different tenet systems. And although I've spent a lot of time since yesterday thinking about all the other things we've been talking about, and I still have more to say about that, none of which will be new to you, but it's like, I guess, practice to go over these things together and think about them. But I still think we should go ahead and start by talking about the tenets, and when we'll find a way to come back around, either in the course of the hour or later, to the question of what it means for things to be merely imputations by thought. Our teacher, the Buddha, didn't write a book called My System by Shakyamuni. And this is it's cultural happenstance, but it didn't work out that way. And instead, he talked with people, and then sometimes he talked to people. But sometimes you talk with people or, answered questions and challenged things. And he did that for a long time, and a lot of different kinds of people, lots of different audiences. And sometimes these are very short conversations, and sometimes they went on for a long time. But that's really different from, from writing a book, right? Where you say, well, okay, I'm now going to explain all my ideas in like an organized way. It's like what you do each day, I guess, you would say, what can I say that will be helpful to these people here now? And so that's very useful for those people. But for it to be of help for us later, we have to figure out how to organize what all these different teachings were and how they fit together. And it's not just for us. I mean, this is a problem from early on in Buddhism, people looking back and saying, when we have a question, we can't just go ask the teacher. We have all these different things that are, have been passed down that he said on different days to different audiences, but then someone has to figure out how it all fits together and organize it, right? So Indian Buddhists did that in lots of different ways. There wasn't just one way to say put together what was important and how, which categories or frameworks that Buddha had taught in different ways in different days and different times should be superseded and put within the context of a broader meaning provided by the others. And so there are obviously many different views that developed within Indian Buddhism about what the Buddha taught. Setting aside the question of people not always agreeing upon which things were actually sutras, even setting that to the side, the tradition is that there were 18 different non-Mahayana tenet systems. And maybe it's a good thing, I don't know, but maybe a bad, I don't know, but they're not all preserved. I mean, we don't know really what all the different ones say. For some of them, we just know a name. Now, we know some of them by way of their being refuted in other texts. So there were these people called that who said this. But we don't, but for other ones, we know, quite a bit about these different views. So, just as the Indian Buddhists had this problem looking back on what the Buddhists taught, then there were these so many proliferations of different ways that the Indian Buddhists had tried to make sense out of this. Then all of this came to Tibet. all the sutras, and then all the different ways that all these different Indian thinkers in all these different centuries had tried to sort that out and put that together in different systems, which partially agreed with each other and partially disagreed with each other on every conceivable point, frankly, pretty much. is there a real person, for example? You would think that would have been clear, but no, there was some who said there was. And so there wasn't, you know, there was so many different points of view. And in Tibet, there developed this schema, and this is not just true of Tibet. It happened in China and other places that Buddhism went. People said, well, let's find a way to organize this so that we can explain it and teach the history of Buddhist philosophy and how to think about all the different kinds of things people have said that Buddha said in some sort of structured way. And this is what's taught as trungpa or tenets in Tibet. It's not as though people in India were saying, oh, Buddha taught these four tenet systems, and which one will I join, or which sub-school? And if you're going to go to the Yogacara Svatantrika Madhyamaka sub-school, then you want to go to this monastery, because everybody, that's what we mean by school. It's the school where they teach that. No, it wasn't anything like that. There were all different thinkers and different writers, and sometimes they coalesced, and sometimes within these temporary coalescings, there were still disagreements because everybody had their own ideas. And what I'm trying to say is that the schema of four tenet systems is a device. It's artificial, and it's extremely helpful. I'm all in favor of it. but you have to like realize it's not just a matter of it's a construction from a Tibetan framework for trying to make sense out of the tangle of all these different Indian philosophical systems. And so sometimes people have, as I explained in near the introduction part of Appearance and Reality, by people I mean Western scholars that I go to conferences with are quite negative about this literature, tenets. They have no respect for it whatsoever. Because it's not, in their view, historical, and it's highly synthetic. It's a confabulation, in their view, and doesn't represent anything like this is a distorted view, I think, as I'm saying, but it doesn't represent anything on the ground in India, but it's like a story that Tibetans have made up about what was happening in India. Now, I think this is like going in an extreme. I'm trying to say, look, don't take this as an absolute picture of exactly what was in India. On the other hand, to say it's worthless because it's just a made-up story and we shouldn't bother with it is like going too far. But this is the way I've understood it, is that, like, why do people want to go to the trouble of reading Dharmakirti or Tsongkhapa or Vasubandhu? You know, these are very hard books. And and then trying to figure out the, like, history of how these ideas related to each other in India is even harder, in part because the Indians weren't interested in history. They didn't keep close tabs on which things happened historically in relationship to what other things. So it's just a mess in trying to like figure out, well, if we want to really do intellectual history of Buddhist philosophy in India that's, you know, chronological and is grounded in these texts, it's a very, very difficult, detailed work, which hasn't yet been done by what the Western scholars who are criticizing the Trungpa literature either themselves, but they're trying to do. Okay, so that's, I mean, it's not as though they're just criticizing that. They're trying to do that. And, you know, people make progress. Like, you know, you can see John Donne's book on Dharmakirti represents something different than, you know, what was available when I was in grad school, for example. But my feeling was, starting out in this, that, and I think other people are like this, is like, why do you want to go to all that trouble unless you have some idea what the idea, that's a lot of work, unless we have some idea what the ideas are, a framework for thinking about, well, what kind of ideas are in there, we might not be so interested in engaging in that kind of detailed study. And still, then even when you do engage in a detailed study, you have to have some sort of framework or schema to present them in. I have been, as I mentioned in this book, I've been at conferences where people will present as though it were some profound discovery of theirs, something that Zhang Yong Sheba had written a long time ago in his, you know, great exposition of the tenets, which had been published in Jeffrey's Meditation on Emptiness book when he did his dissertation. But it's like, well, that was a Dharma book from Wisdom Publications, so people didn't really read it or something. And so it wasn't taken as authoritative scholarship or something. And so it had to be somebody later who was, you know, not looking at the tenets literature, but relying on looking at the original texts themselves and saying, do they say this? Not even referencing what John Yusheva had said about what they said, or John Gare or anybody like that. So anyway, it's worth what it's tenets. So tenets, even within the Tibetan tradition, right, is saying, okay, we have this marvelous way of thinking about what all these different Indian philosophies are, and it helps us get a picture in our mind of what of the diversity of Buddhist thinking. It's not supposed to be a substitute for then reading Nagarjuna or Chandrakirti or dare I say Dharmakirti, right? It's not supposed to be a substitute for that. It's supposed to be like, okay, now I know what's out there, and if I want to learn, you know, go back to the primary sources and see what it really says, then, you know, I can see what might be an interesting place for me to start and where my mind might be drawn in. So it's not supposed to be, and this is the same thing with, you know, Yiksha, the texts that are used in the Tibetan monastic curriculum. A lot of people will just read what's in their monastic textbook, and it being very clear to them and written for them in a way that they can use to debate, and then they feel that they've learned these ideas. There's no, most people then don't feel maybe any need or inclination to go back and say, you know, because of course our teachers, you know, had this right, why would I, it would almost be impious for me to presume to go back and read the original texts and think about them on my own, because, gosh, you know, Jaman Sheva did it, Tenshin Sonam Trakpa did it, Jason Shirgi Gyeltsen did it for the, you know, for Sarah. So what, why would I think that I would know better than him, you know, what Chandrakirti meant? And then that becomes kind of an excuse to not, like, mix your mind with the original works. So that's the pros and cons as I'm perceiving it at the present. And of course, you know, the layer of tenet system literature is a huge literature, right? And it's a, there's all different kinds of tenets books, you know, some like are very short, synoptic, like quick handbooks, you know. And then there's at the other end of the spectrum, you have Zhang Sheba's work, which is like a really, you know, a kind of massive compendium of Indian philosophy. And his whole section on non-Buddhist systems is incredibly elaborate, you know, going through everything that was known in Tibet about all the different non-Buddhist Indian systems of thought. Okay. Okay, so that's sort of a general comment about that. Then, what's said within the tradition then is that there are these four views. You know, and this is on page 11 in Appearance and Reality, right? And you guys already know it. Two Mahayana tenet systems, the Madhyamaka or middle way system, and the mind only or Chittamatra system, and two lesser vehicle Hinayana tenet systems, the Sautrantika or Sutra school and the Great Exposition or Vaibhashika school. So, I mean, that's just four. There's four. and of course, you know, you can see that that's just intending to comprehend Indian philosophy. But that was the idea, is that any kind of real legitimate Buddhist philosophical view should either, you know, be some variation of one of some subdivision of one of those four. That's the idea. So you have a... what these four have in common, you know this list too, is that they disagree about everything, as far as like what exists, what practices people should do, and you know what the nature of enlightenment is. But they have in common the four seals, which is that all products are impermanent, all contaminated things are miserable, suffering, all phenomena are selfless, and nirvana is peace. Right? So that's interesting. I don't know if you know where does the list of four seals come from? I saw this recently, but anyway, it's something very, I mean, I think the source for the list of these four seals is quite late. But obviously the ideas that it refers to, that it identifies are, it's a quite a good list that identifies, what is common among different Buddhist outlooks, and is widely accepted. This list in Tibetan way of thinking about different Buddhist philosophical systems. Have you guys seen the book, What Makes You Not a Buddhist? That's like a hot seller right now. You haven't seen it? Hensei Norbu? What Makes You Not a Buddhist? I mean, it's like, it's a beginner's book, right? What Makes You Not a Buddhist? Well, it's organized around the four seals as to what makes, if you say you're a Buddhist, but do you really think that all products are impermanent and so forth? And it goes, that's how the book is set up around the four seals. It's very easy to read and a nice book. My thought about it, since I'm just, I guess it's the nature of academics to want to quibble with things, is like, okay, so I guess that most of the Buddhist world is now out, right? because you go and live among Tibetans for a while and you find out that most of them don't know the first thing about Buddhist philosophy, right? They know how to say, "Om Mani Padme Hum," right? But they don't like, okay, what do you mean by non-affirming negative or something like that? Not going to get too far. So, and it's not just that with Tibetans, right? Of course, it's that way everywhere. People have a great deal of faith in the three jewels who are not philosophically inclined. They're sort of counting on the bhikkhus and bhikshunis and other people who have chosen to devote themselves to that kind of specialized activity to know this kind of stuff for them and to put it into action in their practice. And then the typical Buddhist practice is to try to improve one's mind by getting, restraining bad actions, and by dana, by being generous to other people, these other people being experts who are presumed to be actually understanding what the philosophy is. I mean, that's what it really is in the world, I think, So I would say people take refuge in the three, this is me, people take refuge in the three jewels from the depths of their heart. I mean, not that person a Buddhist, whether they understand the four seals or not. Because that taking refuge is the idea. Now, you may not actually understand the objects of refuge, and this is what His Holiness was on about a great deal, at Lehi, in order to understand each of these three objects of refuge, in a Buddhist way, you have to understand emptiness, you have to understand Buddhist philosophy. And so there is this whole idea that, well, people have taken refuge, but have they really taken refuge? And what does refuge really mean then becomes another much deeper thing that cannot help but engage this philosophy or be grounded in it. I'm not sure how to think about that. I thought of the idea of that it reminds me a little bit of how, the idea that everybody thinks that there's a billion Christians, but if you ask the Christian minister, they'll say, well, most of these people just come to church, but they don't have really very much faith. They don't have very strong idea. They don't know anything about the history. They don't know who Jesus was. They don't know what people have said about Jesus and how Jesus relates to God, at all, except whatever I tell them on Sunday. So their idea is that our whole job is to get these people who are nominally Christians to convert to Christianity. That is, become they have a concept of internal conversion, that is, being Christian. Let's now figure out how to really be Christian. And that seems to me like the situation. I mean, it's analogous to the situation in Buddhism, right? But anyway, I think it's not good to deprecate the faith of people who haven't engaged in philosophical study. I'm not saying that's what Kenji Norbu meant to do. It's a very catchy title, right? And it does get people starting at the beginning to think about this philosophy, right? Anyway, so that's the idea of that there should be a common among these tenets, these four views, and then then there's the question of like who holds them in Tibet, or like how, given that if this is what the Tibetans are thinking, that those are the four views, then what are the who actually holds those views among Tibetans? And you have one of my teachers, the one I was quoting the other day, Kensi Ryeshi Tupten, he said, well, in all the different, and he mentioned four. He didn't mention Jonam, but he said among the four orders of Tibetan Buddhism, there are advocates of all four tenet systems. So he was going to posit that, you know, just because you're a Gelugpa didn't mean that you couldn't be a Vaibhashika. And he was going to say, there are Gelugpa Vaibhashikas, there are Gelugpa Sautrantikas, there are Gelugpa Chittimatras, and so forth. And he's going to say, and same with all the other tenet systems, and you shouldn't think that these are the same thing at all. That, you know, that being a member of a certain Chirluk, you know, Dharma system in Tibet, doesn't necessarily determine your philosophical view, because it's something that you're working out in your own mind. You know, what view of selflessness or emptiness can I adopt and mix my mind with, while at the same time maintaining confidence that what I do makes a difference and actions have effects? And, you know, having great respect, of course, in Tsongkhapa, knowing that Tsongkhapa says we should follow Chandrakirti, it's possible that I could still find that for me right now, that might not be the most helpful way to think. I think I told many of the children this before, but I did meet a Tibetan, a Gelugpa, who told me that he was a Svatantrika, but he wanted me to keep it quiet. He's telling me because I'm a Westerner, you know, and I'm not going to like, he said, don't tell my teacher. I thought he would get in trouble. But anyway, I think that is, you have to separate those things, because you know, the founder of a certain, it's true, you know, that everybody has great reverence for their teachers and they want to follow and embody what their teacher said. But it's about reason and using reason and thinking these things through yourself and figuring out where your mind can get to. And it's not just mimicking, okay, well, you know, I have to be a Prasangika because that's like what, you know, Chandrakirti and Tsongkhapa said was the best one. That's kind of, I think that's not supposed to be the attitude, and I don't think it's helpful. I think people have to think it through themselves and see what works for them at a certain point in time, and then maybe they change and evolve. But there's another attitude which I haven't encountered myself, but I think people could have, and that is a sense of, you know, humility, like that I'm a very low, stupid person compared to Tsongkhapa, so I will take the bottom rung, and I will stay with Vaibhashika view until, you know, and then, and of course, there is this other idea is that, like, well, whichever, you know, view you feel inclined toward, sympathetic to, that doesn't technically make you a Sautrantika, you know, if you have that. If you're sympathetic to the way the Sautrantikas look at it, it doesn't really necessarily count you as a Sautrantika, because the idea of tenets, Trumta or Siddhanta in Sanskrit, Trumta in Tibetan, is that these are established conclusions that you've reached. In other words, you have a firm or definitive understanding of the view that's taught in that system.
What's the Sanskrit word?
Siddhanta, coming to the end of making determinations or establishing things. Yeah.
I think the Chinese speak of four Siddhantas. This is the same.
Do they speak of four Siddhantas?
Yeah, well, I'm wondering if it's the same word.
Yeah, Trungpa is Siddhanta. Siddhanta. Siddhanta.
Okay. Yeah. I'll check and see if they have a list of four. I don't think they have the same schools.
Trungpa is Siddha, right? And uh-huh. And Ta is end, or, you know, yeah, end. Anta. Yeah, so it's coming to the end of making conclusions. So the idea is that you've reached a firm conclusion or a certain... So the usual explanation I've heard is that to really be a Sautrāṇika, you should have realized emptiness as is taught in the Sautrāṇika school. So, like, that's like, well, because I... that's what they say, right? Because then you really have definitive knowledge of the... Anyway, that's the tradition. So, then, you know, as I mentioned, these four tenet systems are traditionally divided into the Mahayana ones and the Hinayana ones. And of course, that's a very complicated, and it is really a confusing thing. First of all, what the tradition says about this is you have to be really careful to distinguish between having a Mahayana view and being Mahayana by path. That's like, without saying anything outside the tradition, this is what the tradition says. Well, it makes a big difference. You can have a bodhisattva, you know, a person, you know, who's has generated bodhicitta, but could have a vaibhashika view. Why? You could, right? And it's like they don't have to have realized the profound emptiness in order to initially become a bodhisattva. And maybe that, you know, they're you could say, looking at it from the, you know, Tsongkhapa point of view, you could say, well, they're just a little farther along on the development of faith and compassion than they are in terms of their development of profound wisdom. And then in that would be the way of saying, of course, you know, you could have a person who by path is Mahayana, but by view is holding one of the non-Mahayana philosophical systems, right? So they're two completely different things. They're usually way of saying is if you're generating the bodhicitta's altruistic intention to become enlightened for the sake of all beings, that's what they mean as being Mahayana by path. Whereas if you're adopting the Mahayana or Chittamatra philosophical system, then that's what it means to be Mahayana by view. And they can be, they don't, it's not the same thing, right? You can have, so this is what the tradition itself says, that you have to be careful to distinguish those things. So that allows room for a conversation like Venerable Chodron was bringing up the other day about like Theravada bodhisattvas and the idea of having realization of emptiness within non-Mahayana systems and so forth. There's not like this kind of very clear absolute difference between these two. It's certainly true if you think about non-Mahayana systems. If you have a non-Mahayana system, you still have to have a bodhisattva path, because where are the future? I mean, in their understanding, right? Buddha passes away, but then and Buddhism dies out, but then there has to be some time that Buddhism comes back again in the future. And that will happen only because there's like a person who's a bodhisattva right now who's practicing to become a Buddha in the future. So there has to be like a bodhisattva path in Theravada. And I didn't hear, you know, it's like they have the word in the context of bodhisattva, but normally they don't talk about the bodhisattva path. But sometimes they do. And that's, you know, it's in some way indispensable to any Buddhist system to have a way that somebody could become a Buddha in the future, whatever you think a Buddha is, right? There has to be a next one. And really, I think the difference is, the way I teach my students at university is not the difference is whether they're bodhisattvas or not. It's not the difference of whether some people aspire to become enlightened as Buddhas or not. The difference is whether you say every one of us has the potential to become a perfectly enlightened Buddha, and therefore it's the ideal that every one of us needs to aspire to enter the Bodhisattva path. That's really not present in Theravada Buddhism. We have an arhat ideal. It's exceptional to find, you know, these texts where there's describing the Bodhisattva practice outside of Mahayana. Whereas in Mahayana, it would be extraordinary to find something saying, well, if you're not feeling up to the Bodhisattva path, here's another little thing for you so you can go into your Nirvana cave. I mean, they wouldn't say like that. And so, but still they do believe it's possible, right? And they do believe that that non-Mahayans can realize the profound, have the correct view, right? You can have somebody who's not generating compassion but realizes the profound emptiness, escapes from cyclic existence. Right? So you can have the view without the aspiration. You can have the aspiration without the view. And so it's not like an absolute kind of divide between the two. It's more emphasis for kind of what you take as the ideal of what we should all do or what is all of our potential. I talked about that. So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the particular of the Vaibhashika system. So, I mentioned this problem of, like, after the time of the Buddha, people trying, Buddha not having written his book, his big book, laying it all out for us, and people are like, well, we're going to have to sort it out, and then you have these texts appear called the Abhidhammas, right? And there's these treatises that are written, right, in, say, 3rd century BCE, roughly, and in which people are trying to, there's seven main ones, and Theravadins say, what?
Well, the Sarvastivada and the Theravada seven are different.
Right. Okay. Since our Sarvastivadin have a seven and Theravada have a different seven, the Theravadins say that the Abhidhamma texts are the word of the Buddha.
Not all Theravadins.
Some Theravadins say that this. That's what I've heard. It's like, oh, they say three baskets.
Yeah. Well, some say the Buddha spoke it to Shariputra and then Shariputra wrote it down. Others say that the Arhats. Wrote the Abhidharma, and then still others, more modern speakers, are saying that it's
written, composed.
Yeah, other people after the time of the Buddha who put together the Abhidharma,
which seems to be more like what other people say who aren't in Theravada.
Yeah,
but traditionally the idea, right, was that in Theravada you have three baskets, and the third basket was this collection of texts, which. appear to be attempts to systematize what the Buddha taught in all his discourses rather than actual discourses by the Buddha. And so, as Venerable Chogyam is explaining, some people feeling very strongly that this had to be the word of Buddha might understand that as being something that Buddha was saying, right? But the usual, understanding outside that kind of traditional Theravada perspective is that some group of persons, right, being aware of this difficulty of sorting out all these different, so many sutras, and trying to organize what they all said, created texts which did this kind of systematizing work. Okay, that's the idea. So, then. A text called the Mahavibhasha appeared, which attempted to comment upon and be like a commentary or critique of the ideas in these different Abhidhamma texts. And this, synthesizing all the different things that the Abhidhamma texts had and sort of commenting on them. And what we call the Vaibhashika school is purported to be the view of this Mahavibhasha. That's why it's called Vaibhashika, because it corresponds to this Mahavibhasha commentary on the Abhidhamma. But, yes, the correction, yes.
No, I was just wondering, because I've heard some people say that actually the Sarvastivada was the main school, and the Vibhasikas were like a breakout group who started their own thing. Is that the common view in academia?
Well, what I've been reading is on this is Paul Williams' book, Buddhist Thought, and his interpretation is, okay, she's introduced the word Sarvastivada. His interpretation is that the Sarvastivada was an early name for the people who came subsequently to be called more formally the Vaibhashikas. Mm-hmm. And he frequently calls them the Sarvastivadins, but he, by Sarvastivadins, he means the same people who come to be called later the Vaibhashikas. So it may be that there were some people who were called Sarvastivadins, and then at once the Mahavibhasha emanating from their camp came to appear, then people came to know them by the name in relationship to that text.
Or then maybe there was a split off.
There could be some Sarvastivadins who didn't agree with the Mahavibhasha, right? And then you have yet another group, right?
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, well, that's the way I understand it, and this isn't like something I've spent a lot of time on, but I think that the Sarvastivadins were the, as best we can understand it, the Sarvastivadins were the base group from which what we're calling the Mahavibhasha and then the Vaibhashika position arises. But a complication in this is that the Tibetans are all saying, oh, well, this is what the Vaibhashikas say, and it's based on the Mahavibhasha. They didn't have the Mahavibhasha in Tibetan. They didn't actually know what it said. And even today, it's not, I gather, it's only partially translated into Tibetan. And so everything that's said in the tenets literature, you know, which has been around for centuries now, it doesn't really, it says, well, this is what we understand to be the view of the Vaibhashika is based on the Mahavibhasha. But it's actually based on the root text of Vasubandha's Abhidharma Kosha, the verses of Abhidharma Kosha, not the commentary, which are taken as representing the same or similar view, right? Whether they really do or not. But so anyway, let's just say that what Tibetans take and present traditionally in this tenet system as the Vaibhashika view is based actually on Vasubandhu and not on the text that it's supposed to be, you know, connected to directly. But it may be, though, that there's some, you know, there is some close overlap. It's not, it's just not the fact that you can't say these are the same things. Okay, so anyway, what does that, all being the case, what do they actually say about the two truths in this Vaibhashika? Maybe I should say one more thing because you brought up Sarvastivada. Sarvastivada, you know what that word means? Yeah. Sarvastivada, the ones who hold the vadins, the ones who advocate the view that everything exists. And what they this meant, one of the things this meant was that all the dharmas of the past, present, and future exist. It's not just like the present exists, like everything of the past, present, and future exists. And then how do you tell the difference between you know what I'm about to say, how do you tell the difference between the present ones that are operational and the past ones, which also exist, right? If you think, well, that's so weird, then you can think about our conversation about Martin Luther King, you know, as to why people would... this is actually had this argument in Western philosophy, too, about whether we can talk about, you know, Abraham Lincoln as existing or not, and so forth. And the people who say, no, only what exists in the exact present can be spoken of as existing, those people are actually in the minority in Western philosophy. Because it becomes so difficult, you can't say anything, right? Because it's already gone before you. So anyway, so the Sarvastivadins solved that problem by saying, well, all the past and present and future dharmas exist, but there's something different about the ones that are present, and that is that they have their own nature. They have their own nature. They have svabhava. They have, in Sanskrit, the word, the thing that comes to be used as the word for the object of negation later on. You know, they have some intrinsic property of being right now that the other ones in the past and the future don't have. Okay, anyway, so that's the vaibhashikas emerge out of that context, and they're associated with this idea that things truly exist. Things do. They're, you could call them realists in a sense. You sometimes use that way of talking, but they don't all. These things that exist, or you could say truly exist, they don't all exist. They don't all get their entity. They don't all get their nature in the same way. Some things get their essence, their true nature, by virtue of being irreducible substances, which can't be, you just like can't get down any farther. And other things, well, conventional truths, get their nature because they're what we call a whole collection of these irreducible substances. That's basically the idea in shorthand. Okay, so we have a very strong sense of what the wholeness and integrity of ourselves, of our bodies, of all kinds of things. It's like something we're always trying to protect. It's like it's so strong, you know. All it's not something that's part of one particular culture or one particular personality type. It's pervasive, right? That people want to have a sense of where I end and everything else begins. It has a very important boundary, and there's a sense of wholeness and integrity that I want to maintain all my parts together as mine on this side. And then you know, anthropologists have argued this is why there's so much concern, you know, about pollution taboos. It's not because people were afraid of bacteria that they, you know, regard feces and blood and spit and mucus as contaminating. It was because these things were transgressive, like fingernail clippings, you know, of the boundaries between what's the person and what's not the person. And it's like you're taking the body apart into little pieces. This automatically, you know, these was part of my body a minute ago, but now it's not part of my body. Hair clippings, you know, just about everything. You know, when you look at this cross-culturally, pretty much the only thing that's part of the body and then comes off it or away from it that isn't almost universally considered taboo and gross is tears. But except for tears, which, you know, some have, you know, are often put in sort of special category, everything else is just thought of as what makes people uncomfortable and disturbs, disrupts our sense of wholeness. And of course, what, you know, Buddhist meditations have always done is say, yeah, but this sense of wholeness and integrity that you're some real person that exists and is completely temporary and artificial. And if you see that object of desire and think that that person has some intrinsic wholeness and desirability that's, you know, radiating from that side, but, you know, check out the charnel grounds and you can watch the process. And then the people actually, I mean, it's a little bit more difficult to do right now, right? But they actually, you know, they have their bodies there and they could go and see, well, these are the parts of the body and this is how they come apart and this is the different kinds of fluids that are there and different kinds of substances. And what we call a person is just this kind of collection that's imputed to the body and then this stream of consciousness that's temporarily associated with that particular stream of matter. So I think this is a very important idea here, that these people, the Vaibhashikas, were saying we're trapped in cyclic existence because we're attached to a self which we're imputing to this collection of parts, but when we search among the parts, we don't find any such self that's graspable as what we're believing in. Instead, you know, we find when we break things down, only these aggregates and as irreducible things. So they had this. This is the key, the definitions of the two truths. You probably heard them before, but from Vasubandhu's, if the awareness of something does not operate after that thing is destroyed or mentally separated into other parts, then that thing just exists conventionally. Before I give you examples, I'll read the definite. Ultimate truth is a phenomenon which is such that if it were physically destroyed or mentally separated into parts, the consciousness apprehending it would not be canceled. So basically you have the reducible and the irreducible. There's something that they use the word in Sanskrit, dravya sat. That's what we translate into English. It's zayir in Tibetan. It's substantially existent, we usually say. Something, or in Western philosophy, they call it primaries. Something that, like, is fundamental, irreducible, first order, can't be broken down any further, not made up by the mind. It's what we're looking for when we have these conversations. Something that you can really get down to and build everything out. It's true, you know. It's like it's true, you know. The person's built out of this stuff, but what's, you know? Okay, so there's that stuff. You know, bile is part of that. My bile must be real. Well, no, bile. We could break that down further, but yeah, when you break it down far enough, there must be something that we can really, you know, is the foundation bit, you know, out of which we can build. Depending on how we put it together, bile or blood or bone or pus or whatever you need, you know, to make the person, right? Yeah. So that's what they believed in. They call these, talk about these things as particles sometimes, irreducible particles. They have two kinds of particles, directionally partless particles. Directionally partless particles are like infinitely tiny bits of matter, and they have to be directionally partless, because if they had a north to south, a east or a west, then they would have parts. So that's what it means to say they're directionally partless. You're having a hard time thinking of a point of that's also a matter, but that's their idea. As like directionally partless particle, and then there's like different kinds of directionally partless particles. You can't like break up a directionally partless particle, but the directionally partless particles are of different sorts, and they're made out of what's called substance particles. And these substance particles can be co-located in different combinations to make up different kinds of directionally partless particles. So directionally partless, I know it's like, I know. Well, but this is what they say. So, like, how can you have these co-located substance particles? Because these substance particles lack the quality of resistance that keeps two things from being in the same place at the same time. But, on the other hand, when you put together 6 to 11 of these substance particles, depending on the situation, put them together, you know, when they're co-located to constitute a directionally partless particle, then these directionally partless particles do have resistance. That is, they're not able to have, you cannot have two directionally partless particles that are in the same place. That's how you can build stuff, is because each of these directionally partless particles has resistance. It can't be like put in the same place with the other one. Okay, so you can think about like Zohar, well, this isn't our way of thinking about fundamentally what stuff is made out of. But if you're thinking about like, well, we have this problem, you know, it's like, well, what is, you know, we have to have an object of imputation for our thought table. What's the table made out of? And then you go down farther and farther, then you're thinking, well, they don't have tunneling microscopes or anything like that. So they're thinking, like, what are the irreducible components of tables? And really, my sense is that this was done in terms of meditative experience. I mean, that's the kind of microscope they had, was vipassana, meditation, to see, like, what's the finest elements of this that we can notice or observe. You know, what can we really see as being there? So, you know, water is considered. Okay, so there are examples of conventional truth. Conventional truth is something that when it's physically smashed or mentally broken up, the mind that observes it is canceled. So obviously a pot isn't, this is an example, you know, a pot or teacup is an example because, you know, you drop it on the floor and then the mind that says cup just like goes because, right? So that's pretty easy to understand, these kinds of things. Then they say water is also water, or because water can be in all different shapes and we can, you know, spread it out and so forth like that, and we'll still say water. But on the other hand, their understanding was that you could mentally separate water into different components, the taste of water, the smell of water, the feel of water, and so forth, and that water could be reduced into these further irreducible elements by mental analysis, not by physical distortion. So they have this idea that conventional truths are of two types, ones that are shapes, you know, that would get their basis reputation for being a shape, like a cup, a pot, a book, and so forth. And then when you smash that shape physically, then cancel the mind that apprehends it. That makes it a conventional truth. It only conventionally exists. On the other hand, there are other kinds of conventional truths which, you know, you think like a mass of water that can be divided and changed into different shapes and spread out and so forth, and the mind doesn't disappear. But you can mentally, and this is an important concept, I think, actually. There's several important concepts that, you know, in other aspects of Buddhist philosophy. It's not just a matter of being able to physically break things up. Can analyze in the imagination, tearing something apart into smaller components and say, well, look, even if I can't actually take a quark or a string or a point instant of the smallest noticeable instant of my experience of anger, and if there's no way that I can like physically divide it or notice something smaller that's what's in it, I can still understand conceptually that that moment of anger has to have a beginning, middle, and an end, and I can mentally divide it up into parts, or I can mentally analyze what are the different components that are there without thinking of it as something as irreducible. And so that's what they're doing. They have this idea that things can be mentally broken up or things can be physically broken up, but either way you do it, there's going to be some things that can't be broken up, right? And they take as examples of things that can't be broken up are that the mind apprehending it is not canceled. Both the directionally partless particles, the substance particles, temporally partless moments of consciousness, which are just like, I've just been doing matter, but it's the same thing with consciousness. You have temporal, just like you have directionally partless particles of matter, you have temporally partless moments of consciousness, right, in the same way. There's not a beginning and an end. And then uncompounded space, which means like the space that pervades everything, whether there's matter here or not, and nirvana would be examples of things that are irreducible.
Water, fire, and air?
This is so confusing.
Yeah.
It's absolutely right. When they give the example, Vasubandhu gives the example of water as a conventional truth. He's not talking about the substance particle, right? But what are the substance particles? This is on page 20 in Appearance Reality. Within the desire realm, each of these, I'm calling them here conglomerate particles. It means these directionally partless particles that are built up out of the substance particles. Each conglomerate particle includes at least 8 substance particles in the desire realm. And that's earth, water, fire, air, form, smell, taste, and touch. So that, when Vasubandhu says that water is a conventional truth, he's not talking about the substance particle, elemental substance particle, water. He's talking about water as a mass of water. Okay. And then there's, you know, all these different things. If a conglomerate particle is part of the body of a living being, then it has body sense faculty in addition, which is another substance particle. If it's part of I understand in your system, you have involved in perception, you have the object of perception, and you have the consciousness, And then those are the things we usually talk about. But you also have this sense faculty. You have special, subtle material within the body that makes it possible for us to see, and special, subtle material in the body that makes it possible for us to hear, and so forth. So that, you know, if it's any part of the body of sentient beings, then you have the body sense faculty substance. If it's, in addition to being part of the sentient being, also part of the sensory material in the eye, ear, nose, or tongue, then you have another substance. That makes 10. If sound is present, then you have a 11th substance particle. So you can get up to 11 if you have a noisy room with the body of a sentient being, and you're talking about a substance particle that exists in the subtle material in the eye that sees forms. Then you would have 11, assuming that person's in the desire realm. But in the form realm, the substance particles of odor and taste are absent. And thus, if you don't have any of the other things as well, you could get down to as few as 6. So generally there's 8, but depending on the circumstance, there can be anywhere between 6 and 11 of these substance particles in each one of these conglomerate particles. I'm sure you're highly edified by that. Yeah. That's interesting to think about, though, the problem of, like, it, you know, saying, let's just watch our experience, right? This is what you're doing, and try to see what are the irreducible elements that are there in our body and our mind. And that's what they're doing. And saying, we won't take it that the apparent integrity or wholeness of ourself is a given. We'll see what we can break things down to. The assumption here, and this is like, is that people suffer unnecessarily because they exaggerate how real things are. They falsely impute a kind of reality to things that they don't have. That things have been built up into something more than what they are. The assumption is not that nothing exists or has its own nature. Of course, something has to really exist, and really exist by way of its own nature, as the foundation for building up these artificial constructions that we falsely become attached to. They just take it for granted. It just seems obvious that there has to be something real. It's just that that's not what we're seeing or getting at. And do you see what I'm saying? When I've said the definition of ultimate truth, it's true, nirvana is listed, but it's not like, okay, it's not the point is we'll realize nirvana and then we'll be free. No, the idea is you become liberated by seeing that realizing the lack of a self that you falsely attributed to this conglomeration of conglomerations. But all of which ultimately does have an irreducible basis. That's the idea. I think it's important to think about that, because it's like lack of intrinsic nature, lack of intrinsic nature. And that's like not a given in Buddhist philosophy. I mean, all these Abhidharma systems just took it for granted that there were things that had svabhava and things that lacked svabhava. And the idea was to sort out which was which, and that people would suffer unnecessarily because they would falsely attribute some kind of real nature to things that didn't have it. But that didn't mean that nothing had it. Of course some things had it. You know, that's how that's why we get confused, is because we have some basis of imputation. There's some real things out there. And when we look at them, we superimpose on top of that some artificial extra thing that isn't really there. There has to be something real that's there, don't we? We feel that, right? You feel there has to be something real that's there, that's the basis of our superimposition. It feels like it ought to be out there, even though we don't believe this account of what it is, but we think that there ought to be an account that says what things are in themselves apart from our telling a story about it. And this is what their story about. Like, well, there have to be these real things that are the basis for making up our superimpositions. So, I mean, am I getting you converted? But one of the things interesting is that, you know, they think, well, I'm going to point out a couple of things about this. One of the things that I really like about this is that when they define ultimate truth and conventional truth, it's exactly in terms of mind from the very beginning. It's not, they say, you know, we'll know that something is a conventional truth if the awareness of it does not operate after the thing itself is destroyed or mentally separated into other things. It's not like, the whole It's not just like a unique thing to Prasangika to suddenly, or, you know, or to Chittamatra, therefore to Mahayana, to suddenly begin talking about that the mind is important, right? Mm-hmm. This is in the Pali Canon, it's implicit in the other systems. They all take the mind as very important, and both in causing our problems and as being the, you know, the training of the mind as the way to becoming free from our problems. And so their definitions of the two truths are not in terms of, oh, let's set aside the framework of all that subjective stuff and just talk about, apart from that, what things are. No, it's like, well, conventional truths are those stuff that you can know that they're not irreducible. Why? Because when you break them up, the mind that was going X is no longer, you know, is no longer present because the X has been destroyed. And you can think of, you know, if you can imagine, space is an interesting one. So they think of, you know, uncompounded space, like space that's all pervasive. They think it's like, well, if you break it up into parts, then what's left? Space still. You know, you can't, there's not like some non-space part that space is built out of. No matter where you draw the lines through space, you know, like fit, you know, smaller and smaller, still what's left is space. So that's the idea. It's like you can't, you can break some things up into smaller and smaller parts, but without losing the sense that, oh, there's that kind of thing. So a good example is of the same kind of idea. It's like, okay, so we think of, you know, if we think of the cup as an instance of form, then the cup is a conventional truth, because when we smash the cup, then my apprehending cup is canceled. But if we think of it that this is form, then when we smash the cup, then we still apprehend. We apprehend form before, we apprehend form after, and we smash it smaller and smaller. So it's like not anyway, there's different ideas about what should be finally taken as. Once you have the definitions in place, I think it's fun to sort of play around with, well, what do you think should really be counted as irreducible, rather than going by, you know, the concept of what's irreducible, what's not irreducible. What is it that I can break up into parts and the idea of it just vanishes and seems to disappear? What is it that can be destroyed by reductive analysis? And is there something else that can't be? I think that's the idea, and you can then, if you have that idea, then you, it's like you can try to see what things feel like they're ultimate truths for you, right? That seems like more interesting than saying what, you know, their specific list was to me. But okay, so that's one thing. And then the other thing I wanted to say is that so they think that, like, ultimate truths, of course, ultimately exist. Of course, right? Because the mind that looks to say, what is this really? What is this ultimately? Comes only to it. That's exactly what we mean by something being irreducible, is that when you analyze it and look into it and say, what is it ultimately? What is it really? You don't come to something other than it, than that you come again to it, or it as its own nature. And so that's what I said. These irreducibles, primaries, drugs, things that exist substantially or in a primary sense, they exist ultimately, right? They don't necessarily. I think saying and therefore they're ultimate truths could be a retrofitting of two truths vocabulary into the system. It's not clear whether they actually use that language, but that it's, you know, this is the way Vasubandhu defines it. Yeah. I think that, I don't know what else I wanted to say about this. Let me see. Okay. So at the end of the chapter, I tried to think about, like, what, and I already really said this. This presentation brings home the message that we have an ingrained predilection to see a gross sort of wholeness in ourselves, our bodies, and the external objects we encounter, failing to reflect upon the fact that such phenomena are imputed to a collection of parts. Consequently, in our mind, these things take on a solidity and substantiality which they don't really have. conventional truths in the system are subject to disintegration, but we ignorantly apprehend them as unchanging and permanent. We mistakenly see them as independent realities, when in fact they rely upon the aggregation of things other than themselves. So they have this idea. They've used the phrase for conventional truths. For the things that exist conventionally and subject to deconstruction, they use the phrase pranyapti sat or dayur, or they're imputedly existent things. So imputedly existent things in Sarvastivadin/Vaibhashika, imputedly existent things that are imputed to exist by mind, exist. But they exist in a non-primary way. They exist in a reducible way. They're actually said to truly exist because it's appropriate to say chariot in relationship to a collection of chariot parts, because it has, you know, there's an appropriate designation of that in relationship to chariot. They would say it has the ultimate basis of being able to be called a chariot, even though we can break up the chariot into parts, none of which is the chariot. As there's a foundation for this, even though it's an imputed existence, they take it, they don't say, therefore it's canceled out and doesn't exist. And this, of course, has a lot of parallels, you know, with what goes on in the prasangika system. Yeah, you want to ask a question? I have a lot of other things to say, but I don't know, maybe too many things to say to fit into this class. Yeah.
It might be small, but I don't know. Why were they also called the Great Exposition School?
That's the same. Great Exposition. Great Detailed Exposition. Mahavibhasha.
That's the translation of Mahavibhasa.
It's that translation of...
Right, Vaibhashika, Great Exposition School is the translation in English of Vaibhashika.
Okay.
And it refers back to the name of that text that, which the Tibetans didn't really have, but presumptively, you know, that was the view that was in there. Yeah.
Would you say that Vaibhashika is more sophisticated than, say, the scientific materials? Most people seem to think in our contemporary times.
Well, there's something called scientific realism, you know, which are sort of a naive scientism, right? Or bad science with bad philosophy, where people maybe think that there's something real that exists in and of itself from its own side, that scientists have magically been able to go outside their own labs and own consciousness and discover from its own side. And, you know, I mean, the problem is that is the way most scientists think, but they sort of can't help it because they're humans and that's the way we all think. And they have philosophy of science that tells them that's really not what you're doing. They probably all get exposed to it, and some of them study it more than others. I don't know. I think here's something that I've been thinking about recently. I don't know if it relates to this. It's like in science, there's all different kinds of science, right? And this is like well known, right? They have this hierarchy of the sciences in terms of, and it's like substance particles, conglomerate particles, and then like bigger things that are made out of those, right? So what do we have? Biology. Well, maybe there's something bigger. Anthropology, sociology, then biology, then chemistry, then physics. Well, then, and you have some, you know, things that are kind of in between, right? Mathematics. Is mathematics like in the hierarchy below physics? More fundamental than physics? Yeah, it's the primary. So. Yeah. Yeah. Mathematics is a complicated one to figure out what to do with. But yeah. So each of these sciences has its own way of talking about or describing everything that's present in this room. And but the way they say it is like, well, these are different levels of explanation. And that, you know, so you can have true, you know, legitimate models, working models that like pertain to the same space at the same time. You can have objects that are found by one science that are not discernible by another science because they're operating in a different level of explanation. But the idea is that there should be a way in which the that it's not like they're all kind of like equal, but that if you really understood physics, then everything in chemistry would follow. And if you really understand chemistry, then everything in biology would follow. And if you really understood biology, then presumably everything in anthropology and sociology would follow. I mean, that's the idea of reductionism. And that's the kind of, I mean, this is a reductionist system, right? It's saying there is something real. And so the idea is like, well, the concept I think that's implicit in that kind of, that there's not just different levels of explanation, but there's a clear hierarchy of these levels of explanation, is that there's some real things in terms of which everything will would or could be explained if we could get down far. And the physicists are working on that right now. And they haven't found the conglomerate particles, but they found some other things that, you know, they have charm and strange and those things. They're just as strange sounding as the right top and so forth. Yeah.
Really kind of lost you. Could you go back to describing the substance particles and what you meant when you said that they could be
co-located
to make another direction particle?
Yes.
This is all about the conventional truth.
Yeah. Oh no. Well. These particles are ultimate truths.
The particles are?
Yeah, because they're irreducible bits out of which everything else is built. So the examples of conventional truth are pot and water,
right.
And what I was talking about, cup and so forth. Examples of ultimate truth, you have uncompounded space, irreducible particles, nirvana.
This thing about co-locating things, is that
okay, so... Yeah, well, it's that they have directionally partless particles, but in order to have different types of directionally partless, if you just have one type of directionally partless particle, then how would you build a diverse and complex universe? So they have different types of directionally partless particles. And what makes one directionally partless particle different from the other? Well, it has to have different parts, but these parts can't be physically in different places because it's directionally partless. So
there's no east, west.
Right, there's no east, west, north, south, top, bottom. So a directionally partless particle consists of 6 to 11 substance particles that are all in exactly the same place with each other. And by being in that particular, you know, set, being present, then that is what constitutes that directionally partless particle, is being sort of part of my eye or part of a god's ear or part of that pine tree or something like that. Are you having trouble with the idea that these little particles are all together in the same place?
I'm having trouble with this entire
conversation. Yeah.
I can't get past the between irreducible and reducible and the fact that it's not made up by mind. However, if it's smashed and the apprehending mind is canceled,
Let me go over it. Conventional truth is the thing where when you smash it or destroy it by analysis, the mind apprehending it is canceled.
Okay, got that.
Ultimate truth is the thing where when you tear it up or try to tear it up, you only come to it again, and therefore the mind apprehending it is not canceled. So that is what I'm calling reducible and irreducible. Reducible means subject to analytical reduction to something other than it. And irreducible means something that exists substantially, irreducibly in a primary sense, such that you can't break it apart into something other than it. Now, do you follow?
So that's the substance particles uncompounded status nirvana.
Yes, those are the irreducible things. I said, well, yes, generally. But what I wanted to say, if you got that, is that it's a little unclear, like, okay, which of these particles, the substance particles or the directionally partless particles, are they counting as the irreducible things, right? So, you know, if you read this in here, I make the argument that it just really doesn't make any sense to say that the directionally partless particles are irreducible. But they seem to be saying that, but I don't understand that, because it's obvious that you can mentally tear them apart into the substance particles, even though you can't physically break them up. Mm-hmm. But they do seem to be saying that. So I wrote in the book, this is what they say, and then later on I said, well, you know, if we think about it and play around with these ideas, I mean, we don't have a complete list. We just have these little bits, right, of what they said. It's sort of a reconstruction. And so we can think of, like, well, if these are the definitions, how do we think it would work in terms of things? And that's what I tried to do. And also, it's not just me. I mean, this guy, Naong Beldam, you know, this Mongolian Gelugpa scholar, did the same thing. He went, has his book called The Two Truths and the Four Tenet Systems, right? And he goes through and he says, well, this is what they say, and here's some problems with it, and let's see, you know, if we think about what they're saying, what would it seem to imply? I mean, that's philosophy. Right? Yeah.
Are there other, like, things in Buddhism that the Vaibhashika tenet system is, like, widely accepted about, even if not on the two truths?
Let me see. Well, this idea, the other idea for which they're known, I guess, is this idea that, like, all these things of the past, present, and future exist. That seems to be, like, probably even more famous as an idea for them than this irreducible bit. Those are the two things that, and then there are other ideas. Okay. I don't know if this is a case of what you're asking. Another doctrine, which is not relevant to the true truths directly, and is also confusing, is that they have an idea of causality not necessarily going with the arrow of time. And so that's kind of like what in Prasangika, you know, we talk about fuel and fire, and we say, you know, fuel is and fire are dependent upon one another reciprocally, but we try to make the distinction that, you know, fire arises from fuel in one sense, and fuel is imputed in dependence upon its relationship to fire in a different sense, but not as a cause. But they use the word cause to talk about, they just use the language of causality to talk about things that could exist simultaneously being causes of each other and things that exist after being causes of things that were before. But what they mean by that is not crazy, you know, they mean a cause in terms of a necessary contingent condition for us to speak of such, I think. So Dudasang, it's just like I guess you say opening our minds to thinking about the way that dependence doesn't flow. You have another question? Oh, okay. All right, go ask a question then.
Okay. I'll do a simple one first.
All right.
So, back to the beginning part, you were talking about fundamental vehicle. So,
yeah.
And they had the Bodhisattva idea because they needed to have another Buddha in the future. But then are you saying that they didn't believe that every person had Buddha nature?
That's right.
Okay.
That doctrine, as far as I know, appears in the Lotus Sutra, and you don't see it in, I don't know of non-Mahayana teachings about all having Buddha nature.
And even not all the Mahayanas agree that everybody
right.
has Buddha nature.
No. There are Mahayana sutras that have people of different lineages, three different lineages, yeah.
And some people can never become Buddhists.
They're called Ichantikas. That there's some people, yeah. That even in some Mahayana sutras, you have people who will never become Buddhas. people who will become, you know, hearers, people who become, you know, solitary realizers, solitary Buddhas, and people who have the Buddha nature. So there's four, you know, possibilities for what your nature would be, and people would be interested in finding out. Then, you know, you guys kind of have a Calvinist effect there. Right. No, that's what made me think of it. It's like, oh, it produces that anxiety to find out whether I'm among the elect or not. And that produces a lot of motive. That's the way that works. You know, it's like everybody's really anxious. I would like to feel that I have the bodhisattva nature. And so then you engage in behavior, which tends to confirm that hope and encourages people, you know, to be more bodhisattva, like, lest they feel that they're in a chantaka, you know, and they never escape from cyclical existence. Okay, go ahead.
And then in appearance and reality, when you're talking about this whole historical idea, you talk about it as being yogic. So that gives me the idea that this wasn't like conceptual, that people saw in their mind this in a yogic way.
I feel that, as I try to allude to this a little bit, I mean, I do feel that this is not like all just, this isn't just like people sitting around thinking about it. This is like people doing insight meditation and describing what it is that they feel that they can get things down to. Anyway, I guess I can't prove that, but I that's what people are doing, and so that's the kind of, they're doing a practice. You know, they're not just like scholars; they're monks and yogis and meditators, and their practice is mindful observation of the stream of experience, and the idea is that, you know, we have this idea that we have some permanent self and some independently existing self, but then let's analyze, it was like, well, let's look and let's watch, and when you really watch, you really pay attention, what do you see? What do you see? You don't see the permanent self. What do you see? And then this is the idea, is that they're seeing these kinds of things as the irreducible bits. That's the way I understand it, anyway. And I think, like, all of these Abhidharmas, all the Abhidharma systems are like that. I mean, it's people... Now, it's true that some of the Dharmas that the Abhidharmas enumerate may be... things that people felt were necessary to add in order to make a whole system. But a lot of them are like, well, let's, you know, watch our experience really closely and see what we see and break things down into that. You know. But that's the spirit of the Abhidharma.
I was thinking that it could be the way you're saying, that you have the experience and then they rip up the Abhidharma from that. Yeah. I always had the idea that the Abhidharmas constructed the system as a way to help the people who are meditate isolate what they're seeing in their experience.
Right. I think that's true too, but it's like, why would it not be the same thing? In other words, where would it come from? I think it comes from, you know, they could go through the Buddhist teachings and make a list of all the different things he talked about in different places, I guess. And that's the idea. But I think it reminds me of this thing about the debate manuals, you know, the Yiksha in Tibet. It's like, well, people go out and debate in the Beijing courtyard, and then they take those debates and they write them down, or they formulaically write them down into books, and then people learn them, and then that becomes the basis of debates in the Beijing courtyard. So I think, obviously, there's practice and study have this kind of cyclical relationship in Buddhism, so... I'm sure you're absolutely right. It's like you sit down to meditate. If you've read an Abhidharma text, then you have an idea of what kinds of things you're supposed to be seeing.
Yeah.
And that would structure your experience by creating a framework for your insight meditation. I don't know. It's like, I guess if you were very well trained in the monastery, then maybe some people would have had all these categories in mind when they sat down to meditate. But then other people might do insight meditation and not be told up front, you know, exactly what you're supposed to find.
Related to that, did you know what practices they did?
Well, I don't have, I guess I'm, I guess I really, we don't, I mean, this is, I don't think we know independently from what we can infer from this, like, something about their practice tradition. They were practicing, doing, I would take it they're doing mindfulness meditation, because that's the...
Mindfulness, yeah. Mindfulness of breathing.
Uh-huh. Just that. I think it's
the thing that you could do the practice without all the Abhidharma stuff.
Yeah.
You could have the Abhidharma stuff, and then when you do the practice, it wakes you up to notice certain things that you probably wouldn't have noticed before.
That's what I mean. Yeah, I suggest I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying, as opposed to bringing in certain analysis.
I think, I mean, all through the Pali Canon, there's analysis going on.
Right.
You know, I was thinking about this so often. We have the idea now because of Mahasi Sayadaw, they just sit around and watch their breath.
Yeah.
But, you know, Mahasi Sayadaw was recent, and the Pali Canon, there's analysis running through and through.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Right. Yeah. I think that's right. I think that the idea of watching your experience, mindfully noticing what arises, was not probably supposed to be separate from the idea of then also thinking about, well, what am I really seeing here? and maybe you're not. Maybe you go back and forth between these two. But it's like if you're just constantly in a stream of observing instant by instant what arises, then what's the moment when you stop and reflect on what you've learned? I think you have to like say, well, you know, I was watching my breath for and watching all these sensations and they were flowing by like John was describing, you know, the other day, and it's like didn't notice any self in there, you know, and that has to be like a you know, not, yeah. Okay, well, so it's like maybe the other stuff I was thinking about, like coming back to some of the questions that we were talking about. We'll come to an afternoon, and then maybe we can, depending on how that goes, we'll either start Sautrantika or we'll do Sautrantika tomorrow morning. Yeah. Okay. All right.